Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast, the podcast that appreciates a strong surname and thinks that it might be, in some cases, nominative predeterminism. Fenton, have you ever encountered nominative predeterminism? Oh, this is also my co-host, Fenton Costello. Fenton, hello.
Hello, John. Not in real life, but I am a subscriber to the Pop Bitch newsletter, which is like a famous celebrity gossip newsletter in the UK, and they've always got a dedicated segment for it, and it's always a fun little giggle.
Fabulous. Do you know, you were still at school when I started reading Pop Bitch. Fuck.
Were you on the original discussion forums? I reckon you were, weren't you?
No,
on the
original forum? No, one of my friends was. But the lady that founded Pop Bitch, she works in the gambling industry.
No way.
Pretty sure. I can't remember for the life of me what she does or who it's for. It might be in like PR or marketing or something, but there is a gambling connection, definitely.
Because I know there's a Soho connect. It was always run out of a little office in Soho.
Yeah.
A pub in Soho for years. But I didn't realize there was a gambling connection.
There is a gambling connection, but I can't remember who it is and I can't remember who told me that.
And for all our non-UK listeners, it's a celebrity gossip. They get sued all the time. They're always right. And you'll get all the stuff long before it's hit the mainstream press. It's very good.
It really is. And if you're interested in sports, there's a sports version, which is not from the makers of Pop Bitch, but The Upshot I like very much.
I'm an Upshot subscriber as well.
Yeah.
The WhatsApp group was great for when the whole Christian Horner stuff came out.
I bet.
But I'm Dutch. yeah, we had the Google Drive link in there immediately. Yeah, the Upshot's great. They do a really good podcast as well.
I met one person that I would say was, you know, the old nominative predeterminism. And that was a marine biologist that I met. He was at UEA, University of East Anglia, and his name was Tony Dolphin.
Brilliant.
True story as well.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. I only met him very briefly at a party. I was pretty wasted.
Did you give him your best flipper?
No, that would have been so disrespectful towards his work. God, what do you think I'm like when I'm drunk? I'm actually, when I'm drunk, I become like an old-time aristocratic gentleman.
Do you? Off with their heads? Like what?
Not a sloppy drunk, yeah. Around the time of the French Revolution. Let them eat cake. Yeah, so, right, let's stick on the name theme for a second, because I think it might apply to some of our sponsors.
You reckon?
Yeah. Well, think about it, right? Cool. You've got Every Matrix, right?
Yeah.
Every Matrix, not some matrixes, Every Matrix.
Oh yeah,
it's like they knew.
Then, like, if you think of like an odds grid, if you think of like an odds grid.
See what I'm saying? Clarion Gaming.
Yeah.
You know, Clarion Call Gaming. They're giving their Clarion Call to come to Gaming Barcelona Ice. See what I'm saying?
2026. Book your tickets.
I don't know how the fuck OptiMove fits into that though, but it does.
Optimum movement of your players to the next relevant action.
Well, it's the positionless marketer optimoving everywhere they need to be.
Optimization movement.
Are we going to get optimal, splinters optimal, from scraping the barrel?
Movement.
Maybe. But it is a good time as any.
Really,
to...
times are calloused, John. They're calloused. We've scraped the barrel long enough.
We were scraping the barrel 200 episodes ago. But it is a good time to mention our sponsors, because we do feel very strongly about them. Clarion Gaming, ICE Barcelona 2026, 19th of January, that kicks off. 19th, 20th, 21st. Yeah, and me. And I had my book before
what
you.
Are we doing in, what are we doing in Barcelona, ICE 2026, John?
It's a great question, Fintan. We are, I don't know what you'd call it, really. I mean, we've...
Call it the Book Awards.
Well, no, we have got the Book Awards, but it's the culmination of the Book Awards. So would you say we're having the Book Awards orgasm? The Book of Wargasm.
No.
Damn it.
We'll be announcing the winners.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll totally be doing that as well. We are.
Book Awards and the Gambling Journalist Award.
Yes, the Gambling Industry Trade Journalist of the Year Award. We've got some nice nominations for that.
Hang on, so what's the Gambling Industry Trade Journalist of the...
Are you saying if there's a catchy acronym?
The Git Joti.
It's perfect.
Doesn't quite roll off the tongue, does it?
Only because we haven't said it enough. But we'll be awarding the Git Joti at the Gambling Book Awards. And the Git Joti recipient, see, you've just got to use it a lot, and then it will just become part of the syntax. The Git Joti will win a £4,000 prize, which is not to be sniffed at.
Jesus Christ.
Well, we recognise that there were other awards.
Sponsorships are available.
They very much are. But we recognise that there were awards that were simply recognition. But we wanted to give something that was actually, hey.
Meaningful.
You're brilliant.
Yeah.
Go have a nice holiday or something, you know. Go buy drug. No, not no. Go and
go get the good tapas. Go on.
Yes, get the good tapas while you're in Barcelona. So that's what we were thinking with that. We're not dissing the other awards at all. I'm sure they're very nice, shiny trophies. One of them's given by Clarion Gaming. Oh. They do the David Orrick Award, which I think started last year.
And
Will from G3 got it last year. Will did.
Nice. But there's loads of restrictions on that one, right? You got to be in the industry
No. You're thinking of the Peter Mead Award, which is the... I can't remember if it's the American Gaming Association or the Association of Gaming Equipment Manufacturers. But they do the Jens Haller Award, which is for contribution to the industry. I loved Jens. Mm. What a geezer Jens Haller was. And the Peter Mead Award, which is a recognition for journalism in the industry or for communications in the industry. So actually that can be not just journalists. Although friend of the podcast, Howard Stutz has won that one. I think he was the second winner.
Nice.
But yeah, you need to be in the industry for 10 years for that one. Whereas we'll have any old scum in ours.
No, it's just... Look, it's a meritocracy, right? Do the best work, win.
Go. Yeah, a true meritocracy, which is...
That's the word I was looking for.
It's a rare... It's okay. I was just going to monkey with this in post-production, so it just sounded as though you mumbled or something. Did it pretend that it was an AI sentence?
You do that a lot.
But I'm going to from now on.
Good.
But... So we've got Clarion Gaming. We've also got Every Matrix there, one of our beautiful sponsors. Have you got the ad read for Every Matrix handy?
No.
Oh, no, I tell you what you've got. You've got the one for Optimove. I've got the Every Matrix one.
Okay, I'm going to start furiously typing. I thought we had one for their event in...
We've got the SBC Lisbon one. We are slick at this. Sponsorships are available. And possibly more sponsorships soon.
We too could be promoting your brand right now. Associate yourself. You're the best.
Or us. No, but it's a valid point to say that every Matrix is delivering advanced turnkey platform technology to the global regulated iGaming and lottery industries with outstanding results. Wouldn't you say? I mean, do you disagree, Fintan?
It's exactly what I would say. I think they just signed Danske Spil today.
They did. They've signed a couple of big deals in the last month.
Denmark's, state operator migrating their stack over, and that's a big deal.
They're doing something right. Well, it just goes to show that they are powering the world's biggest brands, and they are solving the biggest challenges, and they are taking businesses to the next level. And do you know why, Fintan? It's because with every Matrix, everything is possible. Anything you'd like to add to that?
I think that was a full stop.
Yeah. But you could mention something about Optimove. We haven't talked about them.
I could mention Optimove.
Other than Optimove, to get their name mangled.
Should I play your game? So Optimove are the gambling industry's number one CRM platform. They power over 50% of the EGR Power 50, or over half the EGR Power 50, plus many more brands, big companies, small companies. They can deal with anybody. They were doing AI before it was cool. If you want to make more money from your business, plug in Optimove and start using it. Super simple.
And tell them that you came via us and they'll give you a month for free. That makes it a basic no brainer. That's like what's the 12th?
Like a drop in the ocean.
No, what's a 12th in a percentage as a discount? Fuck.
Oh, well, you're not going to just buy it for a year, then.
I don't know. Maybe.
I'm not going to do that on here. No, I'm
so slick.
Clearly, this is why I'm in marketing. All right.
Okay. This is why I'm in nothing. But going back to the original theme, nominative predeterminism, that does not apply to our guest, but he does have a strong name.
He does have a strong name.
So we are joined by, it's our second author episode, isn't it? So related to the Gambling Book Awards, but it's a unique book. The author's name is Peter Venison. Strong name. It's a strong name. And Peter has written a really personal memoir about an amazing period to be working, but an amazing man to be working with. It's reflecting on his times working for and against Sol Kerzner, who, of course, well, if you're in the gambling industry, you should know that name. And if you don't, are you sure you're in the gambling industry? Because the man's impact on resort hospitality, full stop, never mind with gambling. But the guy's impact on the hospitality industry was massive. And, post-apartheid grew. And we have the best name drop I think we've ever had, and we've got some good name drops coming up, but I think this is peak name drop, and it's not done with any braggadocio at all. It's just Peter's had a fabulous life, an amazing career, and he's met some staggering people, and he's written a terrific book as a result.
Yeah, and for just obviously for those that don't know Sol, it will be the Sun City Resorts.
Yeah,
In South Africa, but it would also be things like what's the one in Mohegan Sun in
America? Mohegan Sun, yeah, in Connecticut.
And then you've got what was the Caribbean one? Paradise Island in the Caribbean.
Yeah, I mean, he was everywhere. Right.
You've probably been to one of his resorts if you're in the industry.
Right? You've definitely heard of them. Yeah. It's an amazing story. It's an amazing story, an amazing career, and Peter's just like the nicest bloke. He's just
look, when I grow up, I want to be as cool as Peter. He was inspirational. Yeah.
When I grow up, I want to have stories as cool as Peter's.
Oh, my God. Could you imagine?
Well, I wouldn't have to repeat the average ones I've got.
I'm surprised you didn't tell me about meeting Eminem.
Oh, no, I've emailed him about that.
You think your story's cool? Guess what I did in Detroit?
I don't know why you think it's right to mock me, Fintan.
Just you never bring it up.
I don't like to talk about it.
I know.
You know me, I'm a very private person. If you go back through the 232 previous episodes of this podcast, and you try and pull out personal information about me, you'll have nothing.
Nothing. You're a closed book.
Solitary panther.
Supple panther. I saw a book. I was at a physio the other day, and they had a bookshelf, and one of the books was called How to Become a Supple Panther. And I'm like, if there's ever a book that I need to send to John, I would click.
And of course, I replied saying, I haven't already got that one, but I've got another book by the same author. But if I'd known that they'd written that, I would have that one. Yeah. Who doesn't need a bit of injury proofing at my age? You wait, Fintan. Fixed your arm. What was wrong with your arm?
Yeah, I couldn't do like basically whatever the muscle was for a bicep curl. It was a tendon or something at the bottom of my bicep to my forearm that just wasn't playing ball. But she did a bunch of manipulation. Buff. Brilliant.
Wow. I had a weird elbow injury once.
Yeah.
It's really odd. I was cycling a lot, right? And then one day I just went weak as a kitten. I couldn't lift anything. It was the strangest thing. And what it turned out I was doing, so the roads were really bad where I lived, and I was cycling only about 3 or 4 miles into work and back. But the roads were awful. And when I was going over potholes, I was standing up on the pedals, but I was locking my arms. So everything was going straight through the elbow joints. And everything just got inflamed. But it was really odd having to phone my publisher and say, I can't come into work today. My elbows don't work.
Because you just like that.
But he said, what the fuck do you mean your elbows don't work? I'm like, I mean my elbows aren't working. What? Why? How? What? He totally didn't believe me. But that's okay. He paid me back with a bad reference a few years later. Yay.
Oh, it's that one, isn't it?
Okay. Yeah, it's that one.
Oh, my. That's a great story.
It's a horrible story. I was fucking homeless. Talk about fucking putting your foot on somebody's head while they're drowning. Jesus. But anyway,
I'll tell you what, though.
What?
Let's go chat to Mr. Peter Venison.
Oh, yeah, let's do that. He's way more interesting. More personal. We now meet this week's guest, another guest from our rogues gallery, I suppose, of Gambling Book Awards submissions. This author, it's a very unusual book. It's an unusual story, and I'm not gonna bullshit you, Peter. I'm about a quarter of the way through.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and the book is Sol, My Friend and Adversary, Sol Kersner. So it's a sort of a memoir biography ish of Sol Kersner. And if you're in the gambling industry and you don't know who Sol Kersner is, are you sure you're in the gambling industry? In the hospitality industry as well, the man's pretty much, I think Titan is an overused word, but I don't think it'd be overused in this instance. Now, I'm really enjoying the book, Peter. And I did say, not going to bullshit you here. But what strikes me about this is you've come at it from a completely, and rightly so, in my opinion, not that that counts for shit, but a completely personal sort of recounting of your time working with Sol Kerzner, working with and against Sol Kerzner. And so it's kind of got this, there's not really a fish out of water thing. So you're British. Mm-hmm. And you traveled over to work with Sol in the late 60s, early 70s?
1970, yeah.
So, you know, for South Africa, interesting times, and times became a lot more interesting as well. At a time when the hospitality industry in South Africa was almost waiting for somebody with this kind of vision, reading the book, it feels almost like Kerzner's like a almost an Ernest Hemingway kind of character. Do you know what I mean? This larger than life visionary who's kind of pulling everybody along in the wake of this vision. And it feels almost like a Wild West story in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it kind of, there wasn't a rule book, so he just made a new one. And you were right at the heart of that, which is, it's pretty amazing. I mean, I don't need to tell you you're amazing. You probably already know that. But also really interesting, I think it's in the foreword, you say, I wrote this because I was wondering if there was a book about Sol Kerzner out there because I thought I'd quite like to read it, and there wasn't one. Mm-hmm. So I wrote this one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no better reason to write a book than writing something that you yourself would want to read. Now, looking at the differences between that period from, say, 1970 until now, I mean, things have changed an enormous amount in resorts, in hospitality, in gambling, etc. Like, do you think, like, the evolution of all of this, do you think it's, do you think we've lost something along the way? Or do you think the evolution is sort of, do you think everything makes sense and we're where we should be? Because part of me wonders, going to Vegas, say, 15 years ago, very different to Vegas now.
Try 40 years ago.
But I think there's a big difference in service standards now, not just in Vegas, but in hospitality generally. But what are your feelings on that as somebody that was one of the architects of this?
Well, it's complex. When we got into the gaming business, which was about the mid-70s, our view was, when we planned to build the Sun City, that was, we had one little casino already in Mauritius, but it was a diddly little place in the Saint-Geron Hotel. So we sort of learnt the casino business by just practice, not by any real training. And when we saw the opportunity to get into the business and supply a casino product for South Africa, we did that in one of the homelands at the time, which I can explain in more detail if you want, but it's basically a hived-off African piece of South Africa, subsequently rejoined South Africa. But at that time, it was said to be independent. The South African government wanted it to be independent, and they tried to sell the world to the fact that they got independent nations of various tribes surrounding them. It was a load of nonsense, but in order to keep up that sort of facade, they had to let these homelands make their own rules and set their own laws. So, of course, it wasn't long before we were able to persuade that particular homeland leader, which was Bakuda Swana, to write casino laws that encouraged us to open a casino. But our thought at the time was not to build a casino, but to build a resort with a casino. In other words, we didn't want to go down the Vegas route. We wanted to make a complete resort with all sorts of facilities for all types of people, be they adult, be they children, be they black, be they white. It didn't matter. We wanted an all-round experience. The casino was part of the all-round experience. What we feared was, just as a group of guys talking about it at the time, we didn't want people who, a lot of poor people, obviously, in South Africa at the time, we didn't want people to be able to step out of their homes and on the way back with their meager paycheck, go into a casino. We wanted them to have to make an effort to go. It had to be a planned trip to go to a casino. Just as in the old days, it had to be a planned trip to go from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. There weren't casinos in Vegas, as you know. The casino city, the Mecca at the time, was Las Vegas. You had to make an effort to go there, even from LA. Now, we decided we weren't going to corrupt lifestyles, let's say, of the general community in Johannesburg and Pretoria and the big cities by shooting for casinos there. In any event, we weren't allowed to by the laws at the time. But we could have just built in Bophuthatswana, where Sun City is, we could have just built a big box casino. And I'm sure it would have been fairly successful. What we set out to do was build a resort with golf courses, with pools, with bowling alleys, with tennis courts, with everything else you could think of, crocodile parks and God knows what, and showrooms, cinemas, all sorts of entertainment activities. And we pitched it that the casino was just not an afterthought, but just one of many things you could do there. And that was partly based on we're trying to build a tourist business, rather than just a casino business, and we're trying to have some form of protection within the society at that time. That was our pitch at the time, and I guess we believed it. We strayed away from it, as did everyone else in later years, but our original pitch was, let's make this a full-blown resort. And it continued in that style, and the other reason for that was we figured that sooner or later, South Africa would collapse in a sense with these homelands and they'd all go back into South Africa. And we figured that sooner or later, someone would want to start opening casinos in the middle of the towns. And if we had something more than a casino, then that would be that would keep us going. That would mean that would still be relevant. Just as in Vegas, which started out, as you probably know with, I'm sure you do, but if you go back to the early days of the Strip, there were casinos, but there weren't facilities for children, there weren't playgrounds, there weren't all the other things, the showrooms, all the other things that came in after to broaden the offering. That was our aim when we started. We even built a huge game park there, you know, 30 miles across. So we did everything to make it a complete place and almost downplayed the fact we had a casino. And in fact, the bulk of our revenue didn't come from the casino. The bulk of the revenue came from the hotel rooms and all the other facilities.
Yeah, it definitely comes across in the book that Kersner, you come back to this very often, how smart he was with figures. It's really fascinating in the book that there are these kind of rules for opening a property, which are, you know, you announce your opening date early. There's no such thing as a soft opening.
No.
Which is, I mean, that's pretty ballsy. That is pretty rock and roll.
Yes.
So you've got an absolutely firm date, but you can also start taking bookings.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, he's definitely thought that one through.
You know, if you do, our thinking, his thinking too, was if you fix a date, then and stick to that and make everybody know you're going to stick to that, it happens. If you don't, it just spreads. Now, you've hired people who are hanging around doing nothing. It may be shambles when you open. You have to accept that when you open and you're still building it the night before, almost, when you open, it's going to be a shambles. You have to accept that. But you also have to accept that people learn quickly in a shambles. they quickly figure out what they better do. If you say, well, we're going to open in 9 weeks' time, so learn these things, they don't start learning them really until 3 days before the 9 weeks is up. So we figured always, let's throw everything at them. Our customers will forgive us. Our customers, when they arrive, will say, oh, well, they only opened yesterday. We'll give them a chance, but the place is great. You know, this is a great place. We'll come again. Now, if they're still shambles 3 weeks later or a month later or whatever, then they won't come again. But it's that volume of work that forces people to learn fast, because they're immediately up against it. And we did that, and Sol particularly, it was one of his mantras, was that if you sort of listed the things that he said are important, that was one of them. You've picked it up.
There are two, I can't remember the name of the resort that I've gotten to in this, but it's in a spectacularly beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two things that really stick out from this particular story for me. One is that Sol, the day before your opening, was raking the tarmac on the drive himself.
Yep.
It's like he was not afraid to be on the building site. He wasn't afraid to check on what everybody's doing and make sure everybody's.
No.
And that's pretty amazing. But the other one is, this is the property where none of the staff turned up on the second morning to do breakfast service, because they'd all had a party the night before to celebrate the hotel.
Right. Well, that actually happens for the same property. His focus, Sol's focus, was not on how this place is going to operate from a sort of operational, practical point of view. His focus he had two focuses before we opened anything. The first one was to get it built. And he would change things up until 10 minutes before it opened, if he thought there was a better way of doing it, because he knew well that 10 minutes after it had opened, you couldn't have the builders and change it. So yeah, he would change, in that case, the tarmac story, he changed the pool. He ripped the pool out. This is a 200-room hotel. He ripped the pool out a week or 10 days before we were due to open, because he'd seen in a magazine a different shaped pool. And the builders all said, good God, you know, we just finished the pool. Why are we digging it up? No, I've got a better idea. So he would focus on getting the product right up until the minute you open the doors. He would then switch his focus dramatically to how it's running. I was the sucker who was trying to get it open from an operational point of view. So I didn't have any pressure from him at all. One of my colleagues, who was the development guy, you know, the building guy, construction guy, he had nothing but pressure entirely, you know, get this everything done and da, 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 da. The pressure, 1 minute after we opened the doors, the pressure switched to me. Why haven't you got all these people ready? You know, why haven't you trained them yet? Never mind the fact I didn't have a kitchen to train them in or whatever, you know, because it wasn't finished. Because it was always on a knife edge, the finish. But it always got done. And then you had this deep end problem of getting everybody up and running quickly. But you're right. He could home in and focus. Now, the other thing he would focus on during the construction was marketing. Because he was absolutely adamant that you have to open full. You can't do what a lot of companies used to do, probably still do, have soft openings. You can't say, well, we'll only let 100 people in. We've got 300 rooms. We're only at 100 people till we get everybody going. Then we'll have 200, then 300. His philosophy was you open full. And therefore, if you're in a place like that particular hotel, which is on the coast in South Africa in a village miles from anywhere, you had to let people know it was going to be there. Because if you wanted to fill 200 rooms, that was effectively 400 people. You had to find a way to have 400 people there the day you opened. And then they would never have been there before. So you had to have a strong marketing campaign. So he, hand in glove, he went with strong marketing campaign, even though we haven't opened, and get the thing built. And never mind how it's going to be run. Venison will figure that out, or someone else will figure that out. And then if he hasn't figured it out, we'll fire him and we get someone else to figure it out. But it was he could be very, very focused.
I think it's that same property where to make sure it was full, but also not necessarily running at a loss or to minimize that. Mm-hmm. I think he came up with the idea that people could only book it in a package.
Yep.
But the lead on all of the marketing was, you can have this room for like 10 rand a night, something like that.
Yeah.
But you have to buy it as a package with full price meals.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You bought a breakfast and dinner with your room. You didn't market it on the basis the breakfast and dinner are going to cost you, say, 50 quid, and the room's going to cost X. You marketed on the basis the room's going to cost one, and the rest of it's the food and beverage costs. So you advertise, big advertising, stay here for $1 a night, sort of thing, which was true. I was pushing it, but it was true. You were staying for $1 a night, but by the way, you had to spend $50 on your breakfast and dinner while you were there. But that was a strong sort of campaign. He had a good eye for strong campaign lines.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the things that fascinated me was also the cultural context of where all this was happening. So, you know, South Africa in the 70s was, you know, obviously a segregated country, but also very religious, you know, so, you know, no cinemas, no drinking, you know, things on a Sunday, everything was shut on a Sunday and things like this.
Right.
And, you know, the first Sun City property, it was open on a Sunday. It wasn't segregated. It was, you know, it's a very different place and time and very modern compared to where it was. And not only the location, but the time, like the 70s, like the 70s in Ireland were also, you know, pretty dark and grim.
Yeah.
And that's incredibly modern. And like, if you think of what you're saying around, like, we're trying to create a resort and like a place people come to deliberately, not just for the gambling, but actually for everything else. If you look at the evolution of, say, Las Vegas, that's kind of what Las Vegas is trying to become now. You know, they've got the sporting teams, the concerts, everything
matches,
else. So, you know, so 50 years ahead of the curve, which is phenomenal foresight, and must have been incredibly brave to do, because you're really going against the tide, you're really going against the cultural norms of the location and where you are, which is, sitting here in 2025, maybe it doesn't feel that big a deal, but in the 70s, like, this feels a lot. This feels like a huge, huge leap.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. It was a huge leap. Yep.
So obviously there was the South African properties, but then were you part of the international expansion into other markets? Like, can you talk a little bit about that and how that went?
Yeah, that's enormous.
Yes. Initially there was some international expansion on the Indian Ocean Islands, and they were basically resorts. We had casinos in them, but small casinos, the sort of casino, you know, you pop in after you had your dinner and maybe blow 10 bucks or something, but nothing really huge. And as I said earlier, we sort of learned a little bit about the business then, and we had some slots and everything, but it was a very, very minor part of the whole thing. So what happened was, Sun City, when it opened, there was already some competition, but it wasn't in South Africa. It was in Swaziland and Lesotho, which were totally surrounded countries by South Africa. They sort of sit in the middle of South Africa, independent countries, ex-Commonwealth, ex-British Commonwealth, obviously. And they had allowed casinos. But to get there, you had to drive a fair bit and to go through a rigorous and lousy customs thing to get there. They weren't well done. So that was all. There was a bit of that there, but we didn't call that overseas. You know, we sort of saw that as a local situation. The overseas part really came after Sol had been forced to leave Sun International. He had been accused of a bribery situation in the Transkei, which is one of the homelands where we had a big casino. In my opinion, and fortunately, eventually the legal opinion, he was incorrectly accused of that. But the nature of it caused a big fuss, and he opted to resign and leave the country. So he went from South Africa, sold up his stock in what was then Sun International, Sun Bop being the one that had Sun City. But we also, in the meantime, had developed casinos in all the other homelands. So we were effectively surrounding South Africa in the homelands, the Transkei, the Ciskei, God knows where. We had about seven of the things. Nothing of the size of Sun City, but all with the same philosophy. You know, they have to be nice resorts with casinos, same philosophy, but smaller. And they played to the other towns in South Africa. Sun City played to primarily to Johannesburg and to Pretoria, and the others played to Cape Town and Port Elizabeth and Durban and the other big cities. And we also had a lot of international. We built a showroom, which was capable of having this Frank Sinatra's and the Queens and, you know, the big stars of the day, and we were able to attract them to come, much against the wishes of a lot of people in the countries they came from. And that was relatively easy because we had a sweetheart deal with the government in terms of taxes. So if you were Frank Sinatra, for example, and you got paid $1 million to perform, we gave you 500,000 in cash or whatever money. And we gave you 500,000 piece of paper that said you'd paid 500,000 to the local government. But the America and Britain didn't recognize the local government. They recognized the South African government. And so they said they would accept these tax returns as if they came from South Africa. So effectively, we were giving them the full million. So Frank got his $500,000 back from his taxes in America. Brilliant. We then billed the government of Maputo, Swana, Ciskei, whatever. We billed them with a promotional fee for promoting their country, which equaled to, if I recall, 95% of what the tax receipt said. So basically, Uncle Sam was subsidizing our performers at Sun City. Oh. And others, and it was a bit ironical because at the time there was a pop song in America called "I Won't Go to Sun City" or something like that.
Meanwhile, I ain't gonna play Sun City.
That's right. You're right. I ain't gonna play Sun City. Well, you're not gonna play Sun City, but meanwhile you're all subsidizing it. So that was quite a good ruse.
When I grow up, I want to find a tax loophole like this. This is my like, dear Santa, please. Yeah. Help me.
Anyway, to go on to your question about international. So Sol eventually basically got kicked out. And he resigned. He sold his shares, took his money with him, what he could, because there was also difficulty with that, with exchange control. But anyway, and he went to England. And he brooded a bit. He got into the gaming business there, but through France. He wanted to do something big in Monte Carlo. The wheels came off because this bribery sort of slur was following him, making it a bit difficult, really, with some of the gaming authorities until he could really clear his name. Anyway, he went to France and managed to persuade, with the help of some lawyers, the French government to allow slot machines in France. At that time, French casinos were very nice places, but they were all go in your dinner jacket and, bow tie and everything else and no slot machines. So they were very upmarket places, but they were fairly empty a lot of the time. We persuaded them that slot machines were okay. The French seemed to look at slot machines like they were some dirty American thing. You know, French people far below the needs of a Frenchman to go to a slot machine. You know, he wants to go and play baccarat. He wants to go and sit at a green table and so on. So they didn't think, the French inland, ministers didn't really think that they were going to take off in France. Well, we got permission to put in 150, well, we got permission to put in as many slot machines as we liked into a casino that Sol had acquired in Nice with others. And it was right off the Boulevard des Anglais, you know, which is the main sort of stomping ground for all the people and the tourists and the beach and everything. And they were immediately doing five times more than the average in Vegas per machine. So we put in another 150. We sort of stripped the basement. And the beauty of it was you didn't have to go in the casino. You just went in like the back door almost down to the basement. And of course, all of a sudden, everybody wanted to have slot machines in France. What tragically happened, we were onto a good thing. We bought four casinos and we were loading them up with slot machines, completely against our previous thinking about building resorts, as you could see. And then one of our partners, tragically, Diane Desane, who was part of the Barrière family, which has still have casinos in France, she tragically got fatally injured in a plane crash. Not dead, but injured, and comatose. So we couldn't, under the agreement we had with that company, expand because we needed her signature, and she couldn't sign. So others jumped on our bandwagon, and the business in France expanded, but not with us. We got stuck with our four, and we had one in Marrakesh as well, but we got stymied. So Sol was itching to go. When he got to Europe, I mean, he got into this business and got it going and caused actually a major change when you think of France now. I mean, the casinos now are all pretty, I would say ghastly places. I shouldn't say that, but they don't have the elegance they used to have because there are slot machines in every corner now in the casino.
There's a slot machine in every pub, yep. Right? It's yep. Everywhere. Yeah.
So anyway, he was itching to go and looking for somewhere to go. Really, to do this. And ultimately, this turned out to be the Bahamas, because for years, he and I had been looking for sites to build resorts in America. And it was impossible because you couldn't find a coastal site anywhere in America where you could get the necessary permissions to build a great resort. We believe that America, particularly East Coast of America, where you had the big cities and lots of them, you know, all the way down and then Central America, we believe there was room for a massive resort, not necessarily a casino resort initially, but a resort where we could do our thing. But you couldn't do it because you try and buy a big slug of the coastland, say in Florida, forget it. There's no way. I mean, when you you look at the islands, the intracoastal islands, they're chock-a-block full of fancy houses, or not so fancy in some cases, but you can't put a parcel of land together, which is why we went to the Bahamas, because we said even the Bahamas will accept an American without a passport, you know, just a driving license. So it was the same thing, really. We thought we'll get into the Bahamas because we can do what we want to do there. And that was really the major international move that Sol made after he left South Africa.
And that was the Atlantic Hotel?
Atlantis,
yeah. Sorry, on Paradise Island.
Yeah. Paradise, other people had tried Paradise Island. Donald Trump had tried and failed. Didn't have the sort of scope in his mind that was required. Merv Griffin, who is an entertainer, had a television show in America. He had tried. They tried and failed. What they built was awful. And we went and said, we have to have a big idea here. So we built the world's biggest aquarium with all sorts of stuff in there. We built 13 acres of waterways you could walk under and have your dinner underwater and all this sort of stuff. You know, we had a big idea and followed through. And it took off. I mean, literally, there are now, I don't know, 3,000-4,000 rooms in that one resort. And we bought the whole island as it went on. We bought the whole of the island. But it was, again, it was a big idea, and it was right next to Nassau. So you only had to go over a bridge to get there. And the airport was 15 minutes away. Airport. Mm. No formalities required to come from the US. So it was like we were building in America, really. That was the kick start of the North American drive. And then we got into the Mohegan Sun, which was the second biggest casino in America, and so on and so forth.
So I've stayed at the Atlantis because it's where PokerStars used to, I don't know if they still do it, but they used to run they call it the PC, the PokerStars Caribbean Adventure. Yes. So it was one of their huge events.
Now, the interesting thing is that the same team that we put together, with myself and Sol put together, of interior design, architect, all those people, we used the same team we did at the Lost City at Sun City. And we, none of us liked the job. And when we built the Lost City, we sat down as a team and we had a sort of brainstorming. Sol had given us a sort of guidelines. He said, what you got to build, guys, what you got to design is something no one's ever seen before. I don't want Moorish architecture. I don't want French architecture. I don't want American architecture, whatever that is. He said, I want something that no one knows what it is. Now, that's your job. You've got to design that. So the architect and I sat down and wrote a story about the legend of the Lost City. It was a load of nonsense, but, you know, we wrote this story about these people who'd been wiped out and blah, blah, blah. And anyway, we all got enthusiastic around the city story. And it guided us because we said, you can't have a sign that says men's toilets or something. It's just got to have a symbol on it because these people couldn't write, you know, people that did all this stuff. So there were all sorts of silly rules we set ourselves, and we stuck to our rules. And we had the best team in the world doing that. So when we came to do Atlantis, we put the same team together. And we worked well together. We got the whole place built in record time. Everyone says you'll never get anything built in the Bahamas in 20 months or something, but we did. And they were a great team. However, when I sat down and had a celebratory drink with them all when we'd finished, not one of them said they enjoyed the job as they had enjoyed the job in Africa. None of them. Because we were building for an American market. And we basically, how shall I put this gently? We simplified it, shall we say. We said it doesn't matter if it's high rise because that's what they're used to, you know, this sort of thing. So we put some embellishment on our high rise. But nevertheless, we compromised our own thinking in building it. And although it does stand out, I mean, it's the hugest building in the Bahamas by far. It still didn't summon up for us, the team that did it. We still didn't leave there with that sort of, look what we've done, we're proud of what we've done. We left saying, oh, okay, you know, this will work. But we weren't proud of it in the same way. And I think the same goes, it then spread into Dubai, as you probably know. I mean, there is an Atlantis there. The reason it's built like it is and where it is, that Sol one day thought, that gaming will come to the Middle East, and where will it come? It'll come to Dubai. Now, probably he's wrong, because if Saudi is going to go anywhere at the rate we're going. But nevertheless, that in the thinking of Atlantis in there for Dubai was, this is a golden place to be. for all these guys who aren't allowed to go gambling, because the minute they are, this will be a great place to put it.
It is coming to work. It's coming. There is.
It's now coming, yes. In the last, couple of years, it's coming.
Wynn broke ground probably 3 years ago.
Yeah.
It's probably two years away from finishing.
If Solid still been around, that wouldn't have happened.
And that would be an interesting butting of heads. I would have paid to see that.
It just wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have happened because, you know, he had a charisma that had these guys following what he was doing. Yeah. The Palm wouldn't be the Palm without Atlantis on the end of it, because it dominates the Palm. I don't know if you've been to Dubai. Maybe you have or you haven't. But
no, it's world famous. I mean,
it just dominates the place. There's no way Sol would have, he would have found a way not to let the others in. But he was, you know, he wasn't well at the end, and he was getting you know, too old to do it. So that was that. But it's because it's only been really after he's gone that it's come.
What do you think? I mean, it's an extraordinary chunk of time. Yeah, the world changed so much in that period when you worked with Sol. Not just South Africa, but, I mean, the world really opened up. And what would you say from that period, what would you say is your proudest achievement, and what do you think Sol's was?
That's a good question. I actually probably, I don't know how boring talking about it, but I actually think the Palace of the Lost City, not necessarily the casino aspect of the thing, but the concept of the Palace Hotel probably was the job that we had the most fun on. And I think in the end, probably the team that did it walked away feeling the proudest of it. I think so. I'm repeating what I've already said, but that just happens to be the answer.
Hey, if it's the answer.
Yeah.
Do you think if Sol were here, he'd chime in on that, or do you think
I think deep down he also was proudest of it too. Yeah, because he was coming back. It was a comeback. He'd been tossed out basically, you know, from there, been sent off to England. And
that's
and,
it. I mean,
this was a triumphant comeback. Mm. The public were all for him.
I only know of Sol what you've written of him, but I don't think I'd want to piss him off. I would imagine he had, you know, revenge in the form of success in mind.
Yes. Yeah.
But it's so. You're talking, I think, again, it's in the foreword. The lady in the bookshop didn't know who you were talking about.
That's right.
Now,
I'll tell you someone. Sorry to interrupt. I'll just tell you something interesting about that. Yes, when I decided to write that book, it was because the staff in the biggest bookshop in Johannesburg had no idea who Sol Kerzner was. However, when we did a launch of the book, in the same bookshop, which is a big place, and they cleared out everything and had a wall of the book on, you know, those sort of things you do. I was only on Zoom because my wife's very ill, so I had to be here. I noticed there were a lot of young black South Africans in the audience. And I said to the chairperson, ask them why they're here. And because they were the people I'd asked didn't know anything about Sol Kerzner, but here were a couple of rows of these people in their 20s, I suppose. And I said, would you mind asking them that? And one of the young ladies piped up. She said, oh, we all knew Sol Kerzner. So I said, well, how did you all know Sol Kerzner? She said, because when we were kids, when we were little ones, and we said to our mothers, can we have a new bike or can we have a new this? They all said, who do you think I am, Sol Kerzner? So they knew this name, but they didn't know what he'd done. You know. Sorry, I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Yeah. Going over to South Africa as a young man, 1970, from, you know, what was a perfectly nice job in London, you've taken your family. Like, were there, I guess this is kind of a two-pronged question. Were there ever moments where you just thought, what the hell have I done here? But also, looking back on that period, that long period in South Africa, and all of the cultural, all of the social change that came to South Africa, which, you know, I think everybody would say some of it has been limited success, limited success. Some of it's been amazing. What are your thoughts and impressions looking back on that period? And what were your thoughts as a young man going over there?
As a young man, I was very dubious about going. My father-in-law was a leading light in the anti-apartheid program here. If you get pictures, old pictures of the Sunday Times, you'll see the old man waving his flag at the front of the from the front line. And there we are. There I am taking his daughter off to South Africa. So it wasn't popular. We, however, rationalized it at the time and said we can do more against apartheid there than we can waving a flag here, which actually turned out to be true. I mean, it was a rationalization at the time, but it was true because when we employed people, we employed them totally on an equal rights basis. Before the casinos, we were building a bunch of hotels, 400, 300, 500 room hotels, resort hotels, and we were supposed to put in three changing rooms, one for blacks, one for whites, and one for what were called coloureds. And in Natal, in the Durban area, also one for Indians. So we just said, screw that. I said to Solomon, not doing that. You can build four if you like. We're not going to do that. See, so, and he totally agreed. So we were, the funny thing about laws is when people ignore laws, and you look at cyclists, say, in London, when people ignore laws, after a while, the laws change. They change to accommodate the fact that people are not following those laws. It's very hard. Once you've got 10,000 cyclists or more cyclists than cars in London, you're going to give in to the cyclists in terms of the laws rather than the cars. And that sort of thing happened in South Africa. We weren't allowed by law to let a black man come into our restaurants, which was a white restaurant to start with. We ignored the law. And we got into trouble now and again. But we would not let any racial influence come into our employment policies or, in fact, how we treated our customers. And, yeah, I got hauled over the coals a few times and a few fines and things. But effectively, we were changing. We were agent of change. Now, I'm not saying we're the only ones that were the agents of change, but we were a big agent of change. So I sort of rationalized that in a sense. Well, we're doing more good here than I couldn't do that if I was living somewhere else, but I can do that here. So from that point of view, it was good. But as the years went by, I mean, we were lucky enough, both Sol and I, to know Nelson Mandela very well. And we helped him when he came out of jail because we had these casinos all around the country. And we therefore had on our boards in those places the leader of all those countries around there, the black leaders. They didn't want to rejoin Mandela in South Africa. Mandela wanted to put South Africa back together as what was one big country, not have all these silly little homelands. Now, he had to fight against these other guys who were now the little kings in the, you know, fiefdom. And he said, no, you got to come back to South Africa. You can be the minister of roads and you can be the minister of whatever, but you've got to bring your country back into South Africa. Now, so we were an engineer in that too, because we lent Madiba our plane and we talked on his behalf to the leaders of these countries and said, look, in the long term, this is your best thing. You know, you must drop your presidency and come back into the fold. So if I look back on it, we were agents for change. And if you talk to Nelson Mandela, which you can't now, obviously, he would agree with that. He would, and he thanked us a lot for it. I mean, he was very helpful to us in the end. But where they went wrong, we of course now had all these places all around, and we couldn't prevent then the central government from saying you can have casinos in Johannesburg or in Durban. So we got these places all out. Now they're going to undercut us, so to speak. Our thoughts to the government, our advice to the government, albeit self-serving, was what you need to do is not build casinos in Johannesburg, not allow casinos in Johannesburg and Durban and Pretoria. Allow them to build in the Sun City area. You know, allow Sun City. We will give up land. We will compete. But let all these guys build whatever they like, whether it's Steve Wynn or whoever it is, let them build in that area. Let's put a damn good train line from Johannesburg and Pretoria that whips their people there in 35 minutes or something or other. But let's develop a Las Vegas for Africa. Let's not have casinos in every goddamn city all over the place. Let's build our own Las Vegas, which will be an African Las Vegas. That was our view, and that's what we worked. And I believe Madiba agreed with us, but he just couldn't get that through all the shabble that went on in Parliament, which is a shame.
What you're saying makes sense. You know, you make a destination to go and do fun stuff.
Yeah, it could have been world beating.
But then you don't have the problems that are associated, not necessarily realistically, but the problems that are very often associated with the opponents of casinos and gambling.
Yeah, and look what's happened. Look what happened in China. I mean, look at the biggest casino. You know better than me because I'm long out of it. But when I first went there, you know, to what's it called?
Macau.
Yeah, Macau. When I first went to Macau, there was nothing. You know, we tried to build a casino there, nothing there. And now it's bigger than anything.
I remember talking to Christophe Leperoux from a company called, he was at GPI at the time.
Yeah.
And he was saying to me, he said, years ago when I used to work in Hong Kong, we used to come over to Macau to relax because there weren't even any cars over here.
No, there weren't. There was nothing when I went there. There was nothing. I mean, that could have been the same. And that's what the Chinese have done. As you said, there's not casinos in Wuhan and everywhere else.
They've added so much infrastructure to make it happen as well. Yeah. You know, all the bridges and all of that.
Now that was Sol's and mine, I have to say, plan for South Africa, which we failed to achieve.
To be fair, in context, I'm not really going to take that as a failure, given everything that you succeeded with.
No, fair enough. Thank
you. It's all relative. Yeah. And also, I want to just go back just a little bit and just, I used the word Titan earlier to describe Sol, and I think that's fair enough.
Yeah, it is.
But you just dropped Nelson Mandela into the conversation like it was nothing. You're just like, Sol and I, we knew Nelson Mandela pretty well. And I'm just sitting here thinking, that's two of them. Sol in a more understated way, in hospitality and gambling, totally. But Nelson Mandela is one of the key figures of the 20th century, I would say.
Well, we were lucky enough. He was out of jail for about 2 or 3 weeks, and he made contact with us. He wanted to. Sol wasn't living in South Africa. I was running the South African company, and Sol was in Europe at the time. But he was on our board, so Sol was coming and going. And in fact, Sol had kindly let my wife and myself live in his house down there. So we were in Sol's house, and Madiba made contact. And wanted to talk about how the future would be. He'd been out of jail, I don't know, 2 weeks. And anyway, bottom line was Sol said, invite him to lunch, I'll come down. Invite him to dinner, I'll come down, which he did. So we invited Madiba for dinner. And our poor cook, I mean, she was just, she didn't know what to do. You know, it's like this. So... Anyway, I said, look, we'll keep it simple because he's been in prison, the man. You know, it's not going to, it doesn't have to be, this is a, like a business dinner. Anyway, it just happened that Sol and the two other guys were coming from the company. They weren't available. They were late. They were running late. Now, the joke in Africa is that they used to say the white man's got the watch, but the African man's got the time. It was sort of veiled inference that the African's always late. Well, exactly on the stroke of the time that we were supposed to be invited for dinner, Madiba shows up, and I'm the only one there. See, so anyway, I'll let him in. I'm sort of overawed. I mean, I'd never met him at that point. And he sort of, you know, so that's just me. And he said, will there be, I've got a driver. He said, they've given me a driver. So I said, well, fine, you can park outside. No, he said, will he be able to eat? And I said, yeah, of course, we'll rustle something up. And he said, and then they've given me a security man. He said, would he be able to eat too? So I'm now thinking, poor old Mary in the kitchen's got two chickens, you know, and now I've got two more people. She's going to flip. So I said, yes, of course. And he said, they will eat the same food as me, won't they? So that was how humble this guy was. And yet he was sharp as nails. I mean, he was a delight to be with because he's very, very intelligent. He had a memory like you cannot believe. And we were lucky to get to know him and meet him on numerous occasions. And he was grateful because we helped him. He was just a marvelous man. Sorry to lose
him. Yeah, it's when you look at the way that politics has travelled, the way that politics has become incredibly polar and all of that, you do kind of lament the loss of what you might describe as sort of an archetypal statesman, which is 100% what Mandela was.
Yeah, and he knew his limitations. After his term, he said, I'm not a manager. You know, I'm a philosopher, rather. I'm not a manager, which he wasn't.
He knew that he was the right man in the position to unite the country.
Absolutely, yeah.
And what was that fabulous film called that Clint Eastwood directed?
Not the one about the rugby.
It was, yeah.
Yeah.
But the role that played in
well, he was so humble. Together. See, he was so humble. I could tell you a lot of stories. I don't want to bore you with them, but I mean, a lot of times, all amazing stories. I mean, just one quick one. We were promoting the Miss World pageant. There were 86 girls. We said to the girls, what would you like to do while you're here? Oh, they all wanted to meet Mandela. So we called up Mandela. He said, I'm not coming to Sun City. He wouldn't go to Sun City. He said, but if you bring the girls down to the parliament buildings, I'll see them. I'll take a photo with them on the steps. So my wife, Dinah, and Julia Morley, who owns Miss World, they get in some buses, which I organise, and off they go to Pretoria the next day. And as they get off the buses, one of the girls slips and twists her ankle, so they have to rustle up a wheelchair. Then along comes Mandela for the photograph, and he sees the girl down at the bottom of the steps in the wheelchair, and he said, what happened to her? So they said, well, she slipped off the bus. So he said, I'll just go down and wish her well. So he goes down the steps, wishes her well. She reaches up and tries to give him a kiss. And he says, well, now I've met Miss Argentina, whatever she was, I have to meet all the girls. So one by one, the girls came by with their sashes on, you know, and Julia Morley introduced them. This is Miss China, this is Miss Botswana, whatever. In every single case, there are 86 of them, every single case, he knew the name of the ruler of that country, whether it was a king or a soldier or a politician. He said, when you go back, please give Mr. X my regards or Mrs. Botswana my regards. Every single one.
Wow.
It was a fantastic memory. Anyway, I won't bore you with any more.
No, I love it. I thought you were going to go like he was doing this to get 86 kisses from like the most beautiful woman in the world.
He would have done, but he was actually a bit shy too, you see, in that way.
That's what we would have done, Fintan. It's not the same thing. That's why he's a leader.
Yeah.
How's the book been received?
Luckily, very well. I mean, I've written a few books and in retirement, and this one it was number two in the South African market. We published it for South Africa, so it ran for about 3 months when we published it in March or April. It was the number two to something. I actually can't remember the name of the number one, I'm ashamed to say. But it's done very well, and it keeps selling. What happened is it went on to worldwide sort of sales online, and these sort of South African diaspora around the world, you know, little groups in Australia and America and England of South Africans, expats who still see themselves as South Africans in lots of cases. And so that market is sort of like a drip feed. So it does. It's done well, really. The publisher is very pleased. I'm pleased to say.
Good. The publisher. I've been communicating with the publisher, obviously, yeah, through the submission process and all of that. Mel.
No one wanted to do it, by the way. People tried to stop me doing it.
Really?
Mel
Ferguson. Yeah.
Mel's a writer herself, isn't she? She's an author herself, and she's got this relatively small, you know, publishing concern. And from the titles that I've seen that they've done, it does seem that she's got, I don't know how to put this, sort of, she's got an eye for something unusual.
Yeah.
She's got an eye for something that's
not
the norm. And to be honest, as a reader, that's exactly what I'm looking for.
Yes. She was in partner. She had her company in partnership with a much bigger publishing company, and when they and they sold out to an even bigger publishing company, an international company, and when they saw what was on their list of books due to come out, and they saw one, there was one called Saul Kirzner, they said, "We don't want nothing to do with it. We're not going to print it. It's all ready to go." So they pulled, and Mel had the guts to say, "Well, in that case, I'm breaking off our arrangement, because I believe in this book." And she said, I'm not having a big publishing company come and squash it, because years before there had been books written about Sol that were squashed, and hundreds of books had to be ripped up or burnt or whatever, because a judge had said, you know, the family had interfered. Or in that case, Sol and his wife had interfered because he was still around. But there have been other attempts to write books about Sol. And one way or another, they've all been squashed. And Mel had the guts to say, "I'm not going to get squashed by these bigger than me guys. We're going to go ahead." So I was grateful, because obviously it could have just disappeared, never to be seen again.
Mel comes across as a great character.
Amazing. Yeah. Well done, Mel.
Yeah.
Yeah, big Super fan, Fintan. So, look, Peter, we haven't announced the long list yet, and we definitely haven't announced the short list yet, so I can't tell you what's going on with that at all. You know, we might see you again, we might not.
Oh, well, it's up to you.
Thank you so much. Your stories are fantastic.
Yeah, it's been a genuine pleasure, and I hope the book does well. Anybody that's looking for it, I believe it is available on Amazon. It's called Sol, S-O-L, My Friend and Adversary, Sol Kirzner. It's by Peter Venison. This is Peter. And as I say, I'm only a quarter of the way through, but I'm really, really enjoying it. It's a terrific read. So I hope it does fabulously. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you so much, Peter. Really appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks a lot.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just @GamblingFiles. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share, tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.